condition many people struggle to overcome, that too many try to handle on their own, alone. But they don't have to, and neither do you. Treatment is available in the privacy of a physician's office. Click on the banner and visit turntohelp.com.
Live 365.
At time, a sovereign mind explores the nature of the game, the game players, and the strategies in place to hold you spellbound and distracted. Informed guests will bring insight to the silent side of corporations, spiritual concepts, science, and technology, and how they're all being used to influence your choices. We will explore concepts and ideas that will stretch human imagination and potential. We would love to have you participate by calling in at 310-928-7733, or you may email your questions to innerlightradio@yahoo.com. My guest today is Jim Elvidge, author of The Universe Solved. Jim holds a master's degree in electrical engineering from Cornell University. He also holds 4 patents in digital signal processing and has written articles for publications as diverse as Monitoring Times and the IEEE, Transactions on Geoscience and Remote Sensing. Beyond the high-tech realm, however, Jim has years of experience as a musician, writer, and truth seeker. He merged his technology skills with his love of music, developed one of the first PC-based digital music samplers, and co-founded Radio Amp, the first private label online streaming radio company. For many years, Jim has kept pace with the latest research, theories, and discoveries in the varied fields of subatomic physics, cosmology, artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, and the paranormal. This unique knowledge base has provided the foundation for his first full-length book, The Universe Solved. Again, let me remind you, you are listening to Sovereign Mind live on Inner Light Radio and BBS Radio on Wednesday, July 23rd. Jim Elvidge, welcome to Sovereign Mind.
Thank you very much, Sonia. It's an honor to be on your show.
All right. I tell you, when I first discovered your book, I mean, it took me 2 seconds because I'm real quick at zooming in on information that, you know, I can see 2 or 3 words and I pick up the whole book in terms of what it could potentially be about. But what I found fascinating was much of what, you know, many of the things, the concepts that you had written about reminded me so much of my own writing that it was really kind of wild. I was reading, I was like, wow, there's other people that are just so out there. And so that was really great. And so what I'd like to have you do before we go into all these questions that I have is, I know I read basic, you know, understanding of your bio, of your background, but I would like to hear from Jim what actually triggered you into attempting to decode this maze called reality. So a little bit of background on yourself from that perspective.
Sure, yeah, no, that's a great question. It's always kind of interesting to see the path that somebody takes to something like this, and I'm glad that it kind of resonated with you, because I find that people either get it or they don't, and, you know, it's really great to talk to people who understand, because then you start with a common understanding for your discussion. So, yeah, my background was, I guess oddly enough, very kind of technical and scientific in nature, having an engineering degree, spending the first part of, or most of my career basically kind of in the high-tech world, you know, just dealing with nuts and bolts engineering and computer science and programming and bits and bytes and all that kind of thing. It provided a good foundation, though, especially the computer science background kind of allowed me to think about how computers work and have a different view of where the world is going in terms of artificial intelligence and how computers are kind of, you know, we're interacting with them in our day-to-day lives. So that did give me that perspective. But over the years, I've always been interested in, you know, a variety of kind of scientific things like nanotechnology and cosmology, astronomy, physics, quantum mechanics, all of that. And I've always, you know, tried to keep up with it, reading the latest books that have come out. And for some reason, I've always been fascinated with the East meets West kind of phenomenon. And there are some books on early books on quantum mechanics, the Tao of Physics, and things like that. That the Dancing Wu Li masters that you know notice the similarities between some of the precepts of quantum mechanics and some of the Eastern philosophies, and that kind of resonated with me as well. Probably about 10 years ago, I started reading a different kind of book, and I guess maybe the first of the type was The Holographic Universe by Michael Talbot. I'm sure you're familiar with that one.
Right.
And I loved it because it provided a completely different paradigm for how the world works. But the sort of side effect of that book was opening my eyes to the idea that some of these paranormal occurrences might actually be real things. Up to this point, I thought, oh, you know, that's just something else. There's a reason for that. It's coincidence or whatever. But it looked like a lot of researchers actually did some bona fide research on various, quote, paranormal phenomena and came up with some scientific results that show that, yeah, there are some kind of subtle energies and things out there that have no scientific explanation. And the mainstream of science avoids it like the plague because, for whatever reason, it's sort of a death knell for your career if you're trying to get tenure at a university or something
right.
like that. But people who write books, they don't care. You know, I could care less. Nobody that I work with cares what I think about physics or paranormal things. So I'm free to think whatever I want, which is
right.
a little bit of nice freedom. So that, you know, I read more on those kind of ideas, and certainly was always fascinated with sort of the pop culture concepts of alternate realities, movies like The Matrix and 13th Floor and even Altered States back in the 80s. And I just, you know, it just triggered my imagination a lot. So I love that kind of thing. With respect to the book, I actually started writing a book about relativity back in 2005, which was the 100th anniversary of Einstein's theory of relativity. But as I was researching it, I came across some ideas. I was looking into quantum mechanics a little bit more, and I came across some ideas about how similar quantum mechanics seems to be to the way computer programs work. And that just sort of triggered a whole different direction to the book. So I scrapped the relativity book, and I just looked for different kinds of evidence that we might actually be living in a programmed reality, maybe similar to that depicted in The Matrix, but maybe a little bit different. And surprisingly came up with four or five large categories of evidence that lend a great deal of support to the idea that reality just isn't what it seems and that there's something behind it that that has effectively programmed it for us.
So in other words, there's a wizard back there somewhere.
Yeah, there's somebody behind the curtain, and you know, it's really been kind of an interesting endeavor to think about these things. And with the website that I put up, I've got people chiming in from all over the world about their ideas, and you know, it's just really been kind of a mind expanding journey.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely beautiful. I completely relate to everything you said, and yeah, you know, for myself, fortunately. I started to figure this most of this stuff out before actually connecting with any book. So that was kind of trippy because I started to kind of figure this whole computer program thing. And I thought, wow. So then I started to see that there were other people coming to that conclusion. But one of the things you said in the book is that, let's see, yes, how do you know that our overall reality is not being produced by an intelligent computer program, which I thought was great, which is what you know you were about to touch on. And so if you want to maybe explore that a little bit, I know your whole book is really about that, but if you want to explore that a little bit in whatever angle you want to explore it from, or I can combine it with my other question or quote from the book. Let's see, what can we know with conviction? And your answer was nothing, which I thought was really great too. And you use the, I guess, sort of an explanation of the 2 plus 2, you know, resulting in 11 or other quantitative values according to that particular reality. So you can sort of go from there and combining or hitting on any which one.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Yeah, no, that's sort of the core of the idea. And early on in the book, I kind of, I present some examples of what I call scientific short-sightedness, and I do that just so that people keep an open mind, because it's real easy to say, oh, you know, that's all just kind of, you know, ridiculous fiction or something. But if you look over history, there have been an awful lot of people who stated things definitively that turned out not to be true. For example, even Albert Einstein, in 1932, said there's not the slightest indication that nuclear energy will ever be obtainable. And there, you know, 15 or 13 years later, we blow up a nuclear bomb. So, you know, even the brightest people in the world just sometimes are closed-minded to some of these ideas. So the questions you ask, how do you know that reality isn't produced by a program, and what can you know with conviction? Those are really kind of core questions. And there really is no way to know for sure, at least at this point in time, and you know, I don't rule out the possibility that some bright person out there is going to come up with an experiment that can prove it one way or another, but I think it's conceptually and philosophically it's hard to do. But it's impossible to know whether reality is produced externally or, you know, perhaps within your mind, or whether it really is the kind of physical stuff that we think. For example, there are an awful lot of kind of research avenues that people are doing right now on the nature of the brain. And for example, at MIT and Caltech, they have performed some studies where they can show monkeys, or even some of these have been done on people now, they show them pictures, and by looking at the brainwave patterns generated by the subject, they, you know, the researchers can tell what pictures they're looking at. So in other words, this is sort of at its infancy, but by analyzing your brainwaves, we can figure out what you're experiencing from a sensory standpoint. And then in the other direction, you can inject into somebody's sensory organs, the visual cortex and things like that, you can inject sensory stimulations that make the people see or hear things. So experiments have been done, for example, on blind people where they can see rudimentary grids of light. I think maybe they're up to 16 by 16 grids these days. Now, that's not any different than sort of the infancy of video games 30 years ago. We were looking at 16 by 16 grids, games like Pong and things like that. So you can imagine with Moore's Law, which is the law that says every couple of years technology doubles, you can imagine how quickly we're going to get to the point where we can inject much more realistic experiences into people's brains. So if that's possible, and it's definitely possible because it's being done now, it's even being done experimentally to the point where you can erase specific memories or you can change specific memories that people have. And there are some well-respected neurobiologists that say it's just a matter of time before we, you know, are writing information into the brain. So that's sort of a fact now, and it's proven experimentally that all this can be done. If you accept that, then you have to accept the possibility that it's already being done, because you can imagine an implant or some mechanism that could be in your brain. It doesn't even have to be an implant. It could be just the way the brain works. where it intercepts all of your sensory signals and sends those sensory signals to some processing unit somewhere, and that processing unit then sends, it processes the signals and sends them back to your brain and makes you think something different. For example, let's say you're looking in a mirror and you see yourself in a mirror, and this mechanism intercepts those sensory signals and says, hey, you know, let's play a joke on this guy and let's change those around so he thinks he's looking at a chimpanzee in the mirror. And you could be completely fooled into thinking, you know, you're looking at a chimpanzee in a mirror, and you could, you know, raise your hand up and touch your face, and then the sensory changes could also be made to your sense of feel, and you could feel a smooth face, but your brain would actually be told that you're feeling a hairy simian face, and you could be completely fooled into thinking you're in a different reality. The only difference is that, you know, you have the recollection of the prior time when before you were seeing these strange things. But then, since memories can be theoretically erased, then it's possible to erase that prior time and replace it with a history of, you know, a happy childhood as a chimpanzee swinging from the trees. And you may think that that's all you've ever experienced. And this kind of technology is in our, you know, in the reality that we perceive today, this kind of technology is maybe only 20, 30 years away. So then there's the question, if it's really that close, how do we know we're not already experiencing it? And the answer is, we just don't. There's just no way to tell.
Yeah, absolutely, because basically what you're saying is, yes, we would then be attempting to mimic a process that started all of this in the first place, which
exactly.
To me would really make sense, because it's like you do with your parents. I mean, you know, they get going, they have you. You are eventually going to, you might not mimic all of, I mean, you know, everything that you saw as far as what your parents did or how they formed their lives, but you're going to take a lot of that and you're going to make it your own. You're going to add to it and recreate. So I absolutely see that. I absolutely believe that, that's what's going on. And you kind of led into, my next question, which is the idea of memory implant, which is going on at this time, as you said. And then you said something in addition, which is that we are only years away from the ability to upload, download, erase, and restore our brain's memory banks, which makes it impossible to be fooled into believing an entirely different reality, which you already went into. You already spoke on that. But I think that those are key things that we have to look at. We're not dealing with conspiracy theories right now, per se, but then we have to look at the fact that, you know, the powers that be, they do have the ability to do those things. You know, that's why they have scientists that
right,
are able
right.
to you know. So we have to really, I think, stop and look at that. Now,
yeah, definitely.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no, I was just going to say, too, that there are really kind of two categories of programmed reality, if you will. There's the one that we typically think of from movies like The Matrix, where a simulation is sort of ejected into your mind. But there's another kind, which is what I call the physical manifestation of reality. And this is where the physical stuff that you experience is actually under programmed control.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this one I think is maybe more likely just from a motivational standpoint. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine. I mean, that was one of the problems with the movie The Matrix, was why are these guys sitting in pods? You know, does it really make sense that the only source of energy computers can get is from human beings? It really didn't make a lot of sense. So if you look at the motivational aspect of it, you know, why would we be, you know, living in a simulation? It's kind of hard to find you know, a rational explanation. However, if you think about the other possibility, physical manifestation of reality, then the possibilities are sort of endless. And, you know, just to kind of frame that idea up, People, your listeners are probably familiar with nanotechnology, and we're, again, this is a technology that we're sort of at the infancy of. But a lot of the theorists talk about a couple of ideas that they expect to occur within, say, 50 years. And one of them is the idea of a molecular assembler. And that's where a device can actually build up molecule by molecule under program control, matter. It could build a gold bar or a piece of meat. I've actually read articles about, there may be a time in the near future where we don't have to slaughter animals to eat meat. We can actually eat meat that's manufactured through nanotechnology if we have to eat meat. Just as an example, it could be anything. You could build a chair or any kind of a pen, any kind of device that you could imagine this way. And in the book Engines of Creation, one of the nanotech pioneers, Eric Drexler, talks about how you could build a rocket engine from a molecular assembler. Well, if you can build things like that, you can build a room. And if you can build a room, you could build, a universe, ultimately. And that's, again, just a matter of scale. And the other aspect to this is something called a utility fog. There are now small flying devices, and they've gotten these down to the millimeter size, and they can fly and they can be under program control, and ultimately they will be invisible, and these are generally referred to as nanobots. So nanobots are these little microscopic, nanoscopic, if you will, objects that can be networked together, like our PCs are all networked together, but they could be flying through the air, and they could be instructed to reflect light or to be transparent or whatever they have the capability to do, so you may not know they're there, and then all of a sudden, under program control, they could turn into a brick wall. Or they could turn into a room. And so, again, we're less than a century away from technologies that can completely fool us into, and it's a different kind of fooling. It's real physical manifestation of a reality built up through nanotechnology. Now, I'm thinking that if there's something behind this, and a lot of the evidence in the book talks about the probabilities that there is something behind all of this, it could be everything I've described so far, the neural implants and the nanotechnology, that's just what we know today. That's sort of our 50-year-out vision. And we, as humans, we don't think much beyond 50 years. We can't really conceptualize what's going to be like in 100 years. Mm-hmm. But if you imagine that this physical manifestation of reality under program control could be done by an intelligence that is way beyond 50 years ahead of us, hundreds, thousands, mm-hmm. millions of years ahead of us, you can't even imagine what kind of technologies they might have to generate this. So it really starts to kind of open your mind to the idea that, hey, our whole reality could be under program control by who knows who, but there's no reason to think that it isn't. The only reason we think that it isn't is because we're sort of stuck in the paradigm of reality that we've been kind of force-fed all of our lives. But right. If you open your mind a little bit, you realize that, it really could be something completely different out there. And some of the studies that physicists are doing now are starting to push the boundaries of that, and they're starting to find experimental evidence that reality doesn't exist, that it isn't what it thinks it is, that time doesn't necessarily only travel forward, and all kinds of ideas that we previously thought were crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like the it's almost like the, I'm going to put it this way, but it's almost like the robots are growing up. I mean, for me, I'm not offended by it because I just as soon start to look at what I'm dealing with as opposed to the alternative, which is to either, remain programmed or remain under, the influence of somebody else's ideas. But I think that that is something that we really have to look at. And I do see that, that scientists are pushing the boundaries. And it is like the computers, you know, are growing up. If indeed there is a future time from which this reality is being masterminded, as you said, you know, then we're probably being observed. And they're watching, you know, the process that we're actually evolving in that manner. So I think that's all very fascinating.
And I think you really kind of hit the nail on the head there, saying to not be offended by it. That's sort of the best advice you can give people. A lot of people get really scared about the idea that, oh, somebody else is controlling things, or they're controlling me, or they're controlling what I'm experiencing. But if that's the case, they've been doing it all your life, and what good does it do to fight it? Because if they're that far ahead of you, you know, you can't fight it, so enjoy it. You know, take advantage of it. Make the best of your life. And, you know, the interesting thing is this is where it starts to pass over into sort of the Eastern philosophies and the New Age philosophies where, you know, all that matters is love and all that matters is happiness. And you know, things like, you know, Edgar Cayce's readings and others sort of fit in real nicely with this idea, which is, you know, maybe we're, maybe there's a reason behind this, and part of the reason is it's a game. You know, we're trying to achieve nirvana, or we're trying to achieve perfection of the soul or whatever, and that's the game we're playing, and that's the game that's programmed for us. It's a lot like a video game, except it just has a different objective.
Absolutely, absolutely. I see it as a giant game, but I do feel that that the object of the game is to figure it out, although there is no ultimate figuring it out. I feel that there is a level, though, a base figuring it out so that you can play the game on a bigger scale. But right now, it's a much more dumbed-down level of the game, and when you're not trying to figure it out, then you don't have to try to figure it out. You know, there are no rules really in one sense to the game. So I do agree with that perspective. You also raised some points about the replacement of our organic bodies with synthetic bodies based on the evolution of science and technology in restoring the brain state of humans into an artificial device for future transference into this synthetic body. this does remind me of the movie Vanilla Sky.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's basically what happened. Did you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. There's a whole sort of movement afoot called transhumanism where people like Ray Kurzweil and Nick Bostrom, who's a philosopher from Oxford, where they're talking about the idea that in, again, the 20 to 30 year time frame, technology is going to start, you know, it's reaching sort of this explosion point where everything is happening so fast. You notice that the world seems to be moving faster almost every year, and technology, of course, is moving faster because it's an exponential growth rate. And at some point, the computer networks that we've built will become, you know, they'll start learning and they'll learn from each other, and they will learn so fast, much faster than humans are capable of, that it's just going to be a completely different world, like almost instantly. So some of those ideas are really explored a lot by those guys, and I differ from their philosophies to some extent. They tend to believe that machines themselves can become sentient, and I'm not so sure about that, at least not in the sense that we are. However, you know, if you believe that the soul or the seat of consciousness is something other than a process in your brain, and again, all you have to do is look at out-of-body experience experiments or results of those to realize that this is almost definitely the case, that the seat of your soul is not in your wetware, it's somewhere else. As long as you can accept that, then you realize that that soul has the ability to decide what, you know, quote, vehicle it occupies. It's occupying this body for now, but if it wants to, if it has the ability to jump from a carbon-based form to a silicon-based form, once that silicon-based form has the strength to support it, if you know what I mean, then maybe there's no reason why it can't, and we could upload our, you know, effectively our history, our consciousness into some artificial means, and then download it, and then you could imagine all kinds of sort of fun scenarios, like, you know, I'm gonna save off my life, put another life in me, you know, another life history in me for the next 1 hour. Let me experience something completely different, and then take it out and restore my old life. And, you know, that it reminds me of this old experiment. You've probably heard of this, where they had these rats in a cage, and they gave them two buttons to push. And one button would give them a morsel of food, and the other button that they pushed would stimulate the pleasure center of their brain. And what the rats did was they just stopped getting food and just spent the entire time pressing the pleasure button. And they ended up dying of starvation. So you got to think, if we get to the point where we can create, you know, very pleasurable realities, I mean, what's going to happen to the human race? Are we going to just, you know, decide not to eat and do the other normal thing?
That as I always say, yes, we're heading for that zone of being blissed out. That's kind of what I always say. But I think what you mentioned about, you know, the bodies, you know, being able to upload, download, shifting your consciousness or to another vehicle, that's one thing. But I think what's separate from that then is the actual robots themselves. We're not talking us per se as sentient beings, but the robots themselves. What I find kind of interesting is these robots are obviously, they're computers. So if indeed that whole thing is evolving, at some point these robots then, because they process so much faster than our brains are able to right now, not that we can't, but right now this is the processing fact. Now, would you say it's either then that we would need to begin to process as fast? Because if we don't you think we run the risk of these robots processing so fast that they're able to supersede human beings in the sense of programming?
Oh, yeah.
This could turn into, you know, they're programming themselves, which, you know, then you have no control because they already are so far gone in their thinking, in their thinking and processing time.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's several avenues that we can go, several directions we can go with this discussion. I'll try to touch on a couple of them. That's definitely a concern. And some people have the more optimistic point of view that we're going to merge with the machines, you know, for
well,
example.
Well, they're going to do that too.
Right. So we'll have, like, you know, memory extensions and, you know, one sort of paradigm that I always think about, which is kind of an odd way of looking at things, I guess, but when you're trying to work with people to, say, build something or design something, you sit around a room and you think about sort of at a system level how the process of creativity gets done, or, you know, creativity amongst a group of people. And you have these brains that are in people's heads, and that's the processing power, and that's the seat of the ideas. And yet, in order to convey the ideas to the other people, there are all these filtering processes that you go through. There's the your brain has filters of, oh, gee, I don't want to say this because what might people think of me? And then there's your, you know, your speech, and then there's the hearing that you have. You go through all these phases where things can get filtered, and it takes time. It takes, you know, a couple hundred milliseconds of human reaction time, and then it takes more, maybe 5 seconds for somebody to kind of absorb what you've said and get it. And if you think about it, it's a really, really inefficient way of doing things, of building things or creating things. But computers don't have those limitations that you can network computers together and have them share information instantaneously at the speed of light. So they're not encumbered by the clunky filtering mechanisms that humans are. So the sky's the limit for computer technology, as you said. Now, what does it mean? Is it going to, you know, create these, you know, T2 scenarios or these iRobot scenarios where robots take over the world? You know, certainly on the surface, it seems like a big risk that could be something that could happen. However, I like to think at a little bit higher level than that, which is if we are living a programmed reality, the programmers aren't going to allow civilization to get destroyed by silicon. There will be some fail-safe mechanism put in there. And, you know, that idea is sort of the history of the world. You know, people had the doomsday clock in the 60s. It was 2 seconds to midnight because mutual annihilation by nuclear energy between the U.S. and the Soviet Union was almost assured. It was almost a foregone conclusion this was going to happen. And people back there, they thought there was no way out. I mean, how could you possibly imagine, you know, a way out of that scenario? But here we are, 50 years later, not worried about nuclear annihilation. And then there was overpopulation in the 80s was such a big worldwide scare, and the people, you know, the scientists were saying, there's no way to reverse this within 20 years. We'll destroy our world. And somehow it didn't happen. So it seems like every kind of technology that we come across, the Industrial Revolution had its detractors, nuclear energy, nanotechnology, cloning, all these new technologies all have a downside and a dangerous side. And the same is the case with artificial intelligence. And yet somehow we managed to slide through unscathed. And why is that? You know, I think it has to do with the bigger purpose. So I'm a little bit of an optimistic, and I'm putting a little bit of faith in whatever that bigger purpose is. And, you know, that kind of keeps me from having too many nightmares about robots running amok.
I think you said a key point, though. I think it's going to be that I'm not even going to go 2 minutes, but 2 seconds before midnight. I think that it will go to probably to that point. To that point, and then something, intercepts it then. But I think that there will be possibly, some humans who, were asking certain questions before and probably have grown in brain access capability. So I don't think that everyone will be dumbed down or lessened version than lesser than the computer's capability. I really don't think so. I think that we human beings have that opportunity to become extremely expansive brain wise. So
yeah, I agree.
So in one sense, yes, I'm agreeing with you that there will be some options. There's another thing I also found interesting. Let's see. You mentioned through some research that you had looked into the difficulty in reviving someone who is dead after 10 minutes, despite the survival of brain neurons 8 hours after death, which sets the conditions for recovery of energy metabolism and axonal damage. Okay, so with that being the case, you concluded that death then had nothing to do, or they concluded that death then had nothing to do with neuron damage per se, but more to do with a conscious choice of the soul to leave the body. Would you discuss that a bit? And you mentioned the NDE report that supports this. And I agree with the conclusion here.
Sure. And I don't have the study at my fingertips, but I actually
read
something recently too about somebody who was declared clinically dead and then revived, many, many hours later. And that just kind of blew away the theory that brain death, irreversible brain death, begins within seconds or minutes of the end of blood flowing through the brain. So that's always been the sort of status quo scientific theory that when you die, you only have 4 or 5 minutes to revive somebody because irreversible cell death occurs that can't be overcome. And that's just, to me, intuitively, it just never made a lot of sense to me. I could never understand why can't you, start pumping blood through somebody's body and get the sort of life mechanism flowing again, say, a half an hour or an hour after death. And the only conclusion I came to was that this, the cell death had to really be so irreversible that you couldn't support life anymore, reanimation after a certain period of time. But the studies showed that irreversible cell damage doesn't occur until something like 8 hours later. So there's this gap between the 5 minutes that they say you have to revive somebody and the 8 hours that they say is the point of no return for irreversible cell death. What does that mean? It just means to me that the soul probably decides time to leave. And,
right.
Mm-hmm. all the attempted resuscitation, there's no reason why it wouldn't work in the event that the soul wants to make the conscious choice to be back in that body, which is why we see these extreme cases of it happening. If the scientists were correct in this, we would never see those extreme cases. So that's additional proof that there is something beyond the wetware of the body.
Absolutely. And I've heard of a couple of stories, actually, from not third party, but in the sense of that person actually speaking of seeing themselves, whether it was in a car accident or whatever the case may be, but seeing themselves and deciding if the body wasn't damaged enough, and I think that's part of what it is too. If the body is too damaged and life looks like possibly it's not going to be something that you're going to be able to work with, that might be a reason for choosing not to return to it. But I've heard people say that they looked and made a conscious decision that they wanted to come back in, and that's when they would, suddenly they're back. So that
exactly
makes sense to me. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you think of it, again, using this sort of computer analogy, let's say you've got a computer system and you just dropped it from a four-story building. Well, you're going to attempt to reboot the system and start running, Office 2008 in that computer. No, you're just going to go find another one.
No, I mean, it's true. It's like we have to start making that comparison. That was what I was doing. I started looking. I'm like, wait a second. There are some similarities here, in terms of the computer and how we work, and it's amazing. You really start figuring out some things. Have you ever seen the movie I can't believe I forgot. It's called
Dark City?
Dark City. Yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned this. Somebody lent me the movie, and I started watching it too late at night, fell asleep doing it. I haven't started it over yet, but it's a similar concept. It's another alternative reality idea, and I like the idea. It does sound pretty interesting.
Well, there's shifting memory around, That's the biggest right. part of the movie is people are thinking that they're, you know, they've been living a life for 40 years, a specific life, and then it turns out that, you know, the memories have been switched, and like 2 seconds ago, they were something else. And so that really makes you scratch your head. At least that's what it did for me when I saw it. Started scratching my head. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, that's one of the things we talked about earlier, too, is, you know, how do you know that you really lived as long as you've lived? How do you know that your whole history wasn't implanted in your consciousness? And you tend to say, oh, that's impossible because I have this friend who has the same experiences as me because of our childhood baseball games or something. But, you know, there's no reason why the consciousness of that person couldn't also have been implanted. I mean, that's just an engineering challenge. That's all.
It's not an
obstacle that can't be overcome.
Yeah, no, I think that it, I know I always laugh and I go, how do you know yesterday was yesterday? I mean, you could just go all kinds of places in your head with it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But I think it's good to do that, though. I mean, it frees you up when you do that.
It sure does. It sure does. I agree. And to me, the thing that really kind of kicked it over the edge was this idea about the nature of reality according to quantum physics. Quantum physics says that when you get down to these really, really tiny distances, 10 to the minus 36 meters, that space is quantized, that it's not continuous. It doesn't even make sense to talk about something in between two points. There's either this point or that point, and there's nothing in between it. And, you know, that's exactly the way a computer works. It's exactly the way objects are modeled in a computer program. They can't have infinite resolution because infinite resolution requires an infinite amount of disk and an infinite amount of memory, which is infinitely expensive. So there has to be a trade-off made, and it's made by the gaming companies or whoever's designing the program, that they're going to limit the resolution of things to a certain amount, just the way our reality apparently is limited in resolution to this so-called Planck length. The same thing in the time domain. Physicists say that at 10 to the minus 43rd seconds, there's no such thing as continuous time. Time moves in chunks. You know, there may be an event that occurs at one point in time and then a little later, but it's impossible to talk about anything in between, which is, again, exactly the way a computer works. It's just clocked at a certain clock rate, and in between those clock rates, there's nothing going on in the computer, and all we see when we see smooth action, say, a video game or something like that. You go to Best Buy, you see some of these video games that look like real life. You can't tell you're watching a football game or if you're watching NFL Madden 08. But all's happening is that they're being clocked at such a high speed that it seems smooth and continuous to you, but it's just a series of states of the computer. And physicists tell us that that is exactly the way our reality works. Well, you know, you see the connection there. It's pretty obvious.
Like a rolling film. Tiny dots coming together. But,
exactly.
Gosh, yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. It really is. I have so many other questions, of course, I could ask you, and we could sit and talk about this just as if it were the two of us, and there's no audience.
If we could.
And no 1 hour to get. But what I want to make sure that you do is, would you give out your website and any information that you would like to give out, if, I don't know, any events or anything else that you might have coming up, but most of all, your website and how people can reach you?
Sure, I'd be glad to. The website is called theuniversesolved.com. It's all one word. And the website, I started out making it as a place where you could buy the book, but it's really evolved into much more of an interactive experience for people. So we have a forum on there where people talk about transhumanism and philosophy and quantum mechanics and nanotech and all their favorite paranormal occurrences and gaming and everything in between, robotics. There's a blog on there. There's a really interesting Powers of 10 section on the site where you can zoom in by a factor of 10 in as far down as you can go, and other Powers of 10 scenarios have sort of limited you to once you hit an atom or subatomic particle, that's it. But I kind of explore the philosophical ideas of quantum mechanics and quantization and programmed reality in there, and you can jump between realities, and people seem to love that. The book you can buy directly from that site. If you do, it's a hardcover book. I signed the copy. And you can also buy it on Amazon. It's soon to be on BarnesandNoble.com. And it's also sold in the Diesel bookstores on the West Coast, and I'm working on some other outlets for it nationwide. So hope people come to the website and enjoy and some of the kind of philosophical and fun discussions that we're having.
Well, I
should also mention.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I should also mention there's a. I have an artificial intelligence on the site too. We've named him Morpheus, and you can talk to him. And you know, the interesting thing is that I've asked people to tell me how smart they think he is, and I've gotten hundreds of estimates. And overall, I think his estimated IQ now is about 79. So he's not real bright, but not too bad for a. For a computer.
I know. I was talking to him at one point. But,
oh, are you?
please be sure to visit Jim Elvidge's website and also pick up a copy of this book. It's really a great book. I really, really loved it. It's a really, really good book, so I encourage everyone to take a look at it. Jim, I want to thank you so much for being on the show, and, of course, I know we'll do this again. And it was definitely an honor.
Glad to. Yeah, and it was a real pleasure to speak with you, Sonia. Thank you very much for having me.
No, you're welcome. And to the listening audience, you may contact me, Sonia Barbs. That's Sonia, S-O-N-I-A-B-A-R-R. Of course, my name is Sonia Barrett, but it's Sonia Barr, S-O-N-I-A-B-A-R-R, at yahoo.com. And you may visit my website at www.sovereignmindradio.com. Join me next Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific time when my guest will be Dirk Vanderpoelhoff, author of Quest of Middle Earth. And remember that the power to be a sovereign mind, a free mind, lies within you. Join me.
Your name is Big Brother. You say that you want to be authentic. Seeing me going away. Your name is Big Brother. You say that you're tired of me, children dying every day. My name is nobody, but I can't wait to see your face inside my door. Writing it down every day. Your name is Junior. I'll change it to don't need it at the bread. Resident of your soul. Thank you.
other side.